From the Partnership for Public Service, you're listening to Transition Lab, a behind-the-scenes look at presidential transitions. I'm David Marchik. Today on Transition Lab, instead of a new episode, we're going to re-release a conversation we recorded in January. It's actually the first episode of Transition Lab ever released, and it features Ed Meyer and Rich Bagger. They were kind of guinea pigs for this podcast. Ed and Rich are two exceptional public servants, and they were key players in the 2016 transition. Rich ran the Trump transition team, working closely with Chris Christie, and Ed was co-executive director of the Clinton-Cain transition. Over the course of the episode, they describe how they became involved with the transition, the work they did, and its emotional aftermath for both of them. We wanted to re-release this for several reasons. First, Ed and Rich describe the ramp-up in work post-convention. It's actually less of a ramp and more like running up a cliff. Second, many of the lessons learned they provide are applicable today to this transition. And finally, our listenership has fortunately multiplied significantly since the first episode, and we wanted to give our new listeners the opportunity to hear Ed and Rich. Here we go. Today, I'd like to introduce Rich Bagger and Ed Meyer, two extraordinarily talented individuals. And in some respect, they both held the most important jobs where you never heard their names. They ran the transition teams for Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton in the last election, preparing for each of them to become president. Ed Meyer has a very interesting background. He grew up in both Texas and Nigeria, where his parents were medical missionaries. That's Nigeria, not Texas. He studied law at the University of Texas and has a master's degree from Oxford. He was a senior official in the State Department in the Obama administration and director of policy outreach in Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. And then he was co-executive director of the Clinton transition team. Rich Bagger has an equally interesting background, but he didn't grow up in Nigeria. He grew up and pretty much stayed in Westfield, New Jersey, where he grew up and he's lived for his whole life. He was an undergrad at Princeton, a law student at Rutgers, and then a very, very terrific career in state and local government. City councilman, mayor, state assemblyman, state senator, chief of staff to the governor. He also has been a very successful business leader. And in the spring of 2016, Rich was named the head of the transition planning group for then-candidate Donald Trump and now President Donald Trump. So let's fast forward to the spring of 2016. We're in the middle of the presidential election. Both of you have distinguished backgrounds, but neither of you had done anything related to transitions. And suddenly someone taps you on the shoulder and says, hey, we'd like you to run the transition, which is to get 4,000 people into their seats in government, 1,200 of whom need to be confirmed by the Senate to manage almost a $5 trillion budget. How did you get these jobs and why did they turn to you? Ed, why don't we start with you?
Well, for me, it really started with a transition event in Pocantico, New York that the Partnership for Public Service put on. And John Podesta asked me to go represent the campaign at this event. And I think he asked me because I was not so essential to the campaign that a weekend away wouldn't kill things on the campaign. But I had enough trust on the key people that I could represent the campaign well. I was personally just excited because when you work on a campaign, you're working 7 days a week nonstop. And this was an opportunity to get in a car. I hadn't driven a car since I moved from Dallas to Brooklyn, New York. And I drove up a beautiful road in upstate New York and went to this conference that the partnership put on. And it was tremendous. I learned a ton. I received the playbook that the partnership handed, met representatives from other campaigns, and really from that point forward started focusing on planning for a potential transition for Secretary Clinton.
How about you, Rich?
Well, so coming out of that same meeting in New York, the Trump campaign determined that it was time to get started on a transition and ask Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey to be chair of the transition planning group. I didn't know that until one night, middle of the night, I was in Tokyo, had jet lag, turned on my iPad, looked at the New York Times and saw that Chris Christie would be leading the Trump transition and immediately had a sense that this would somehow involve me, having been chief of staff for Governor Christie. And sure enough, a few days later when I was back home, He called me and asked if I'd take a leave of absence from my position and work on the transition. What an opportunity to have to be asked to put together a team that is going to work on planning for the transition of power in the U.S. Federal government. So while I had no experience in the area whatsoever, business experience, government experience, but no experience with a presidential transition, jumped at the opportunity to get involved.
So how did you get started? You didn't have experience. It's a mammoth job. What did you do to get ready and get going?
That's a great question, because someone sits you down and say, okay, you're going to put this together. And you're the N of one, the one person. So what do you do next? Well, for me, literally what I did is I took the playbook, the binder and materials from the partnership meeting in New York, got a hold of the transition guide published by the Partnership for Public Service, as well as the book that had been published by the Romney transition team following 2012, read those or like really studied them carefully, and then said, I need to get together and meet with some people who've done this before. We had a full-day meeting with the leadership of the Romney transition team from 2012 to talk with them about how they approached the task, ask a lot of questions, and then met at the partnership, literally within a week or so of taking on the role to both ask questions, to get briefed, and to learn about the resources that were available through the partnership to support work on transition planning.
And for you, Ed, John Podesta was chairman of the campaign. He had been in government. He'd been chief of staff. He pretty much knew how to run government, how to put these together. But you were new to it. So what did you do to get smart?
Similar to Rich, I absorbed everything I could that had been written and really thought about what are the implications of that for the 2016 process for Secretary Clinton. And John Podesta was obviously a tremendous resource and expert in this area. So I had a lot of conversations with John and also with others that had run transitions. You know, one of the great things about working with the partnership and going to Pocanico was the exposure to transitions from other campaigns that otherwise I would not have been able to reach out to. It was easy to reach out to the Obama folks, but I was able to connect with the Romney folks and then also people from the Bush transition and pick their brains and figure out kind of lessons learned, what worked, what didn't work, and just started thinking through strategically and working with people in the Clinton campaign about what the structure should look like.
You were in the same room together. After the conventions, you were in the same building together. Was that a little weird while your bosses, then candidate Trump and then Secretary Clinton, were building themselves up and tearing the other person down, as is a normal in a campaign? You all were working together, collaborating, talking in the same room. Was that weird?
It wasn't as weird as you might imagine it could be. It really, I felt like, you know, looking across in meetings where we were in the same room as Rich and the Trump team, you know, my colleague Ann O'Leary and I were the co-executive directors, and we really emphasized with our team that this was a real, you know, responsibility that we were preparing for governing. And in that sense, you know, we weren't sitting around trying to think of the next political hit to throw at candidate Trump. We were solely focused on how we were going to take the promises that Secretary Clinton was making on the campaign and implement those into the first 100, 200 days of hopefully a presidency. And in that sense, it felt more like governing than it did politicking.
Right.
And that's what it was. Rich was more of a colleague in a sense, more than a political competitor, because we were learning about transition and really working on this great responsibility to move into a governing phase.
So Rich, you're in the same building as Ed. Did you ever find yourself in the same elevator and have awkward silence in the elevator, like we're both going up together, but we're going to different floors? Or,
well, we were definitely working in close quarters, and it was certainly interesting, but I agree completely with Ed's comments. We would meet together every month or so in the White House for the White House Transition Coordinating Council. We'd also meet periodically with the agency transition directors in the executive office building. And I remember, you know, sitting in those meetings, really being incredibly proud as an American that participating in a system where an outgoing administration is briefing representatives planning transitions for the competitors for the presidency during a very contentious election, but sitting down together about the fundamentally important things for continuity of government.
So let's talk about how this works. So Dennis McDonough was then the chief of staff. he had a particular view about the importance of transition planning because the Bush administration did a great job on the outgoing year process with the incoming Obama administration. So Dennis would just call you up and say, hey, let's get together and let's meet. How did that work?
If I recall correctly, there was a set schedule. I mean, you can't really give enough credit to Dennis and the work that he did running this process from the White House. He was tremendous. He was very fair, very transparent, very organized and structured about the entire process. And that went all the way throughout the entire administration. The way they handled it was tremendous. So, you know, we would go into the chief of staff office with the chair of, our chair was Ken Salazar, and with Governor Christie and Rich and Ann and myself would go there, and Dennis would assemble the entire White House leadership team, and we would go through briefings and we'd walk through the process. And it was, again, transparent, fair, even-handed in how he approached it. And then there was an agency-level process that was run by OMB and Andrew Mayock. You know, we had a set schedule. We knew when we were going to be going to these meetings, and they were organized on time and extremely well-managed.
There are a number of tensions in the whole transition process. The first tension that I want to explore with you is the tension between campaigning to win and then working on transition and not being seen to be, quote, measuring the drapes, not being too overconfident, which campaigns have been criticized for many years. So how did you manage that in your campaign?
Well, first, the most important thing to recognize is that before the election, the campaign is the most important thing. So during an electoral campaign, the focus and the priority for the campaign staff is supporting the election of the candidate. And the transition planning process is happening quietly, I won't say so much in the background, sort of to the side, taking sort of direction and following the policy positions of the candidate in the campaign, but not distracting attention or diverting the resources. There's always been a concern, I think probably for as long as transition planning has been done going back decades, about the managing the drapes concern, with candidates not wanting there to be a perception that they're taking anything for granted and doing transition planning. Here, I think the last couple of amendments to the federal transition planning laws makes it clear that there's a structure to do transition planning that's required by law. And therefore, I think that provides some context for why it is happening and helps prevent it from being interpreted as jumping the gun before the election.
Got it. Ed, do you have anything to add to that?
I would just say that we kept our transition team very small. We believe the campaign comes first, and that was the most important thing, was winning the election. And Ann and I were the only two people that actually peeled off from the campaign to do the transition work. And we wanted to keep a very low profile, keep all the focus on the campaign, and keep our heads down and get the work done. And in fact, that was a very strict rule that, you know, we did not want anyone to call attention to themselves and the work we were doing on the transition, keep the focus on the campaign, while at the same time acknowledging that the importance of actually doing this planning ahead of the election.
So there's a third tension, which is there's historically been mistrust between the campaign and the transition team. Going back to the Carter administration, there was a huge apparatus on the transition and then the big campaign. And when Carter won the election, there was a blow up. So how did you deal with that tension in your campaigns? Ed, why don't we start with you?
We kept the campaign fully in the loop on all the major decisions, and we sought their guidance on all the major decisions. And so there's a trade-off in this, right? So one way of looking at this is just completely outsource the transition work, let the transition team plow ahead for several months and come up with a bunch of briefing books and then present them to the candidate and to the campaign leadership the day after the election. That's one approach. We took the other approach where we stayed, you know, in lockstep, kept the campaign up to speed on what we were doing, looked for guidance. The trade-off is that you're maybe a little bit less efficient sometimes, and you've got to wait because you've got to have patience. And if you have a 2 p.m. meeting planned on Sunday for a decision-making meeting with the campaign leadership, but things are too busy, then that meeting gets pushed to the next night at 10 p.m. And you just have to, again, let the campaign come first and be patient and get the guidance from the campaign when you need to get it.
And Rich, you had weekly meetings at Trump Tower. What were those like? Who did you meet with? What did you discuss?
Well, and this tension is very natural and probably always exists, that the people who are working 24/7 to get the candidate elected on the campaign wonder about this other group that's planning a transition, and whether they're really, you know, sitting on the sidelines deciding who gets what jobs, while the most important work, the campaign, is being handled by the people working there. And so that is why the close collaboration and communication and recognizing that the transition works for the campaign is just a fundamental principle. And that's why, you know, a best practice that we followed is that, like, once a week, every week, every Monday, we had an in-person meeting with the campaign leadership in New York City at Trump Tower to go through, you know, provide an update on all of our work, you know, copies of our materials, you know, seeking, you know, feedback, direction, guidance, decisions on the key issues, so that we could then move ahead and try to stay as aligned as possible.
And I would just add that in our case, Anne O'Leary and I, as the co-executive directors, both came from the campaign. So that gave us the advantage of really knowing what it was like, having sort of street cred with the actual campaign, that we knew the pressures the campaign was under. And then also that we had those close relationships with everyone. So it was easy to pick up the phone or send a text or get quick feedback as needed if we were really pressed.
So how many people did you all have on the transition team?
So I think ours was a lot smaller than Rich's. We kept our staff down to 25 paid people was the largest that actually got it at any point in the transition.
Which is a tiny team to plan the essential
That's right.
organization of government.
It was small, but we felt it was as large as it needed to be. So we were very busy. We had a ton of work. There was probably a little bit of burnout from all of us, but we weren't experiencing anything more than our colleagues on the campaign were. We wanted the focus to stay on the campaign. We wanted the resources and the people to stay on the campaign. And we also wanted it to be tightly managed and not have a few hundred people running around working on transition when we needed those people going door to door and focusing on the campaign, which we knew was the most important piece. We were also confident, you know, we scoped out the work that needed to be done. And we brought on board an amazing set of people. There's 25 of the most amazing colleagues I'll ever have in my life. And we were confident that we could get the work done, and we did.
And how about you? How big was your team, Rich?
But most of the people who worked on the team volunteered. So we probably had approximately the same number of paid staff for the transition. But by Election Day, we had approximately 130 colleagues on the transition who had badges to be able to work in the campaign office, who were working substantially full-time or full-time, and then up to a couple of hundred additional volunteers who'd been tapped for agency teams or to serve on landing teams. But that grew steadily, you know, throughout the course of the transition. When we moved into the GSA space just after the nominating conventions, I think we started with 15 people as our core team. And as we got closer to Election Day, every weekend, we would arrange for the members of the transition team and our volunteers to have opportunities to, you know, travel to key states to work on campaigns on the weekend, both because the volunteers are helpful, but also to help people understand, like, what's most important.
Got it. Yeah.
And I should add that, you know, we had also the agency review teams lined up and ready to go the day after the election. So those folks have
been...
These are people that actually hit the ground the day after the election throughout the transition period, the 73 days in our case, to actually go into each of the agencies, review what works, what doesn't work, what needs to be improved in the administration. So those people had been identified and selected and vetted and were ready to go in the next day, but they weren't on the transition staff pre-election. So we had those people lined up, and then another, you know, the post-election staff was going to increase to several hundred, right. And those offer letters were set up and ready to go out the day after the election.
So we mobilized those agency teams before the election to, like, work on agency briefings and agency memos and analyses to deliver by Election Day, especially for, like, cabinet nominees. And then the idea was that those same teams or very similar teams would become the landing teams that would go into the agencies after the election.
So, Rich, your appointment was announced in May-ish, Governor Christie's appointment. And, Ed, your appointment was announced in August 9th. You know, is that the right time to announce the transition teams, and how did you all deal with the press?
We didn't talk to the press. I mean, we would punt any press questions to the communications team on the campaign. Because our number one rule, or number two rule, I should say, our number one rule was the campaign comes first. Our number two rule was, you know, keep your head down. This is not about us. This is about the work. And we didn't want to call any attention unnecessarily to the work of the transition, and didn't think there was anything that we needed to announce. You know, I think the timing of when you actually announce a transition is, I'm not sure how important that is, to be honest. I think sometime around the convention makes a lot of sense. I think there needs to be work done in advance of that, whether you publicly announce that work or you just have a few people kind of quietly working on those plans. I think it's not too much of an important distinction.
It's very interesting because our rules, it sounds like we're the same, or our fundamental principles, right? And so the fundamental principles are first, the campaign comes first. Right.
That's
winning, right. Winning the election is a priority. The second is that the campaign is in charge, in the sense that it's kind of the transition. We weren't freelancing on policy or anything like that. And the third was to do our work quietly and to keep our heads down. So I think on neither side did we have outwardly facing communications staff on the transition before the election. Any media inquiries referred to the campaign staff, and really tried to do our work quietly and stay out of the media so as to not be a distraction. We kicked off in May, and then sort of the first phase of our work was really June and July, sort of setting up the structure for the transition, setting up our budget, setting up our deliverables, getting ready to go. Sort of that was our readiness phase. And then at the beginning with the conventions became the planning phase that then lasted through the election, that then goes to the real transition itself, the 73 days between the election and inauguration.
So what do you know now that you wish you knew when you were tapped on the shoulder to take this role?
Well, it's something that I knew intellectually, but I didn't know by experience, and it's something that you need to live by experience, and that is how much the work accelerates. The intensity and the pace of the work is not linear, right? Those three phases of sort of like readiness, then planning, and then execution. The work after the convention is probably five times more intense and complicated and demanding than the work before the convention. And after the election is probably five or ten times more intense and demanding than the work before the election. And so part of the challenge is to build an organization, build the processes that is like ramping up considerably in its demands and ramping up in a way that, that's almost geometric rather than linear.
Got it. Now, during this whole process, everybody's asking you for a job. They're asking you, I want to be assistant secretary, I want to be deputy secretary. Your people you probably never heard from elementary school called you up and said, you remember how we were best friends? How did you deal with all the people looking for jobs? And what's your advice to someone that actually is qualified and wants a job?
Go knock on doors in Wisconsin, right, and Michigan and Pennsylvania. I mean, honestly, we steered everyone to the campaign, and we said, you want to get involved, you want a job in this administration, you want to focus on the transition, well, go focus on the campaign first and help Hillary Clinton get elected. Unfortunately, that did not happen. But, in truth, we had a small outreach and engagement team on our transition, two people, but their real job was to plan for how to do outreach and engagement for the 73-day transition period. We were not doing active outreach and engagement, and we weren't really taking incoming meetings. In fact, we didn't do meetings in our transition office with people from the outside. We just, again, kind of kept our heads down, kept the planning going, and were prepared to have a very robust outreach and engagement plan during the transition period. And I conveyed those rules to anyone else that had called me and wanted to get more engaged and find out what their job was going to be.
Rich, what's the craziest thing someone did when they were seeking a job from you or seeking to position themselves for a job in administration?
Well, I was thinking when I worked in state government, that's like the AAA league in terms of job seeking, and then working on a presidential transition, like that's the major leagues in terms of the intensity with which people will pursue opportunities and communicate their interest in it. I mean, one thing we tried to do was to prevent having people just hanging around the transition offices, right? That anybody who had a badge and and could come work there on a daily basis, had a specific job with a job description and a role, and that visitors who came there were coming for meetings because they were on a team, and it wasn't just a place where people could hang around and sort of like become part of the team.
So let's fast forward to election day and then a couple of days after the election. For both of you, you put your heart and soul into this effort. You both did a terrific job. You worked 24/7, 7 days a week. And then you were both surprised. The outcome and the ending didn't end as you planned or hoped.
Donald Trump wins the presidency. The business tycoon and TV personality capping his improbable political journey with an astounding upset victory. Donald J. Trump will become the 45th president of the United States, defeating Hillary.
First of all, Donald Trump won, and most people didn't expect him to win. Many people on the campaign didn't expect him to win. So what was that like, and then what happened?
Well, first, and I'm very proud of the fact that we were ready, right? Throughout the entire transition planning phase, we established like our deliverables, like what we needed to have accomplished by election day, or by what we call day next, which would be the morning after the election. And I'm proud to say that we were ready and accomplished all of our deliverables, and literally brought them to New York and started to execute on the plan of the sort of handoff from the transition planning phase to the transition execution phase, including many and most of the people I was just describing, sort of like moving into roles on the post-election transition.
President-elect Donald Trump announced a shakeup today at the top of his incoming transition team. Vice President-elect Mike Pence will take over as chair, replacing New Jersey Governor Chris Christie.
Once it was announced 2 or 3 days after the election, that Vice President-elect Pence would be becoming the chair of the transition for the next phase, and Governor Christie would be moving to a new role as just like a member of the transition executive committee, I decided that it was right for me to like leave the role as executive director. The only reason I was doing the transition work was because of my relationship with Governor Christie and the fact that he had tapped me to do it, so that it was appropriate that I sort of move out of that role and hand off as well to Rick Dearborn, who carried that forward to the next phase. So by the end of that first week after the election, we'd accomplished a handoff, not exactly the handoff I intended, but to the next phase of the transition.
And Ed, election day,
yeah. So I'm
have pains.
I'm glad the podcast listeners can't see the tears streaming down my face right now. So my family packed up, drove up to New York, and dropped my kids off in New Jersey, where my sister lives. And my wife and I went to the Javits Center for what we thought was going to be the victory party in New York City. And actually, one of my dear friends recalls something I said that night that relates to transition, because as we realized what was happening, I turned to her and I said, our transition website was so beautiful. She still reminds me of that moment. And it just sort of encapsulates just all this planning that goes into this this process and preparation, and then for it to all sort of not be as meaningful as you had hoped it would be. We were prepared to brief who we were hoping was the president-elect the next morning. We had our briefing materials all with us, and afterwards you realized we haven't really planned sufficiently for this eventuality. What happens if we lose? And so as we were driving back down to Washington the next day, I sent a message to all of our transition team who had stayed, most of them had all stayed down in Washington, because that's what we asked them to do, and said, don't go into the office. Come to our house the next day, and we're going to have lunch, and bring your laptop computers, bring anything you have that you need to turn in. And we took care of sort of the beginning of the wind down of all the logistics of winding down this organization we had spun up. And we also just had a moment for us to just be there for each other emotionally. And there were definitely some tears shed. And at one hand, you're having to take care of the logistical responsibilities of winding down an organization. And then two, take care of a team, your colleagues and yourself, who are just emotionally exhausted and crushed. And it was definitely you know, an extremely painful moment, but also a moment where you realize you can't just cry, even though you do cry a lot, but you also have to take care of winding down this organization.
That's probably a moment when both teams being in the same building on Pennsylvania Avenue is tough and a little painful, because like both teams know the eventuality that, you know, in the day or two after the election, one team will be closing things down, yeah, and the other is like physically moving a couple blocks down the street and over, yeah, to the GSA building to move into the space that we'd both planned to move into.
Right.
And
I knew, I mean, we knew Rich would have been very gracious for sure, but we just didn't want our team to need to go back into the building.
So none of them went back in the building.
There were a handful of us that then took all the laptops and took all the fobs and all that sort of thing and returned them to the GSA in the building. So I went back in, and a handful of our team went with me. But for the most part, we didn't want our team to have to go through that emotionally.
Well, Rich Bagger, Ed Meyer, thank you very much for sharing your story today. More importantly, thank you very much for your service to our country. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Transition Lab. Follow us on Twitter @rpublicservice to join the conversation.